Good morning. It's good to be here. I hope you feel that way. For those of you who are visiting with us, we're so glad you're here. As I look out in the audience, I see a lot of visitors, and it's a blessing. Really, the location of this building is a blessing. You can see it off the interstate, and I hope that is a beacon that draws people to this building. And I hope once they get here, what they find are people who are filled with the Spirit, people who are wanting to show God's love to one another. And I know there's a lot of people here, both visitors and members who have a lot of young children. And I know that's a difficult thing to sit here for an extended period of time with young children, and I know there's that pressure of once they start getting antsy or they start moving around a lot, start making a lot of noise, and you feel this pressure. But don't worry, it is a good thing that they're here. We're grateful that you have chosen for them to be here, and I hope you see that as a blessing, as I hope everyone else who doesn't even have children here see that as a blessing that young children are here with us. And anyways, I hope you feel welcome in that. Shortly after I became a Christian, there was a guy in our friend group at church who was a real instigator. He was a great guy, super helpful for me at that time, but he did love a good argument. He would often start his arguments with, "Hey, is it a sin to?" And then he would fill in the blank with some controversial question. One of the questions at hand was, is it a sin to have a burnt CD, to make those for other people? For those of you too young to know what a burnt CD is, think of it like a Spotify playlist, but a whole lot less convenient. Or for those of you who are too old, I don't know, a collection of 45s or something like that, or mixtape. Anyways, there was this guy who would say, like, "Well, that's not really good to do because you're not giving the rights to the songwriters and stuff like that." And so, anyways, we had a lot of discussion on that. Another one that came up a lot, and I take it it's come up with the young people here, is speed limit, right? Is it a sin to drive over the speed limit? That was the biggest one. Man, I remember that dominating our conversation one particular summer. And the arguments would usually just kind of go like, one person would wave a verse in the other person's face, and another person would wave a verse in their face, and essentially the one who gave in first was the loser, and that's generally how it went. Now, I was a new Christian, though. I didn't really know how all this worked. I was certainly trying to figure out, well, what is a sin and what isn't, and I wasn't... The amount of Bible that I knew at that time was that I knew I needed to follow Jesus, and this was the way to go, but I was still learning how to go about this. And the important question of, when you do have a question, how do you find answers to that question? Maybe some of y'all are thinking the same thing. How do we figure out the answer to this question? Whatever that blank is that you fill in, how do we find the answers to that? And there could be this temptation, and we've talked about it in the auditorium class, to wish that the Bible was more of a rule book of sorts. There'd certainly be a whole lot less debate, a lot less internal struggle if it just laid out every single scenario that we could possibly go through, and we would have our answers in that way. I've even heard it compared to, it'd be nice if it was a little bit more like the old law, where there's a much more denser collection of what we should and shouldn't do. But I'd say that type of attitude about the old law, I think, is a misconception as to what the law of Moses was doing. It's easy to think of it as like some constitution that dictated the everyday lives of Jewish people at the time. In many ways it was. But at the same time, I think its goal was to create a people who were more like God, who better represented the image that they were created in. The law was intended to do that. But there was debate even in their own day as to what certain laws meant. There is rabbis who wrote over and over about, well, I think it means this, or I think it means that. Like, there was already some internal struggle as far as what things meant and what things didn't. If God wanted to give a law code that was extensive in every unique situation, I'm convinced he could have. But what he did, even in all the details of the law, what he created was something that was supposed to shape us from within. When Jesus answers the question in Matthew 22 and verse 36, what is the greatest command? Remember, to paraphrase, Jesus says, well, it's to love God and to love others. But then he says in verse 40, all the law and the prophets. So, like, that's shorthand for the Old Testament. All the law and the prophets hangs on these two commands. It's all boiled up in loving God and loving others. That's how Jesus summarizes the law of God. And in Jesus, it's no different. Sure, there are times when there are some easy to understand do's and don'ts and things like that. But the goal of God's law, this new covenant, the covenant that's supposed to be written on our hearts, is to be more like Him. That's what it's trying to get us to do. All right, that sounds great, right? Okay, I get what you're saying. That sounds well and good. But still, like, is it a sin to do this, though? Like, okay, obviously, we're going to keep having those questions. I think that's not a bad question to have. And so what I want to do this morning is to kind of provide some guidelines as far as how can we answer the question of, is it a sin to? And the way I want to present that is what I'm going to call a decision pyramid. That sounds fancy. I'll get into detail there. But if we were to set up like this pyramid of sorts, I think the first step right at the top of that pyramid, what you would want to do is what I'm calling the thou shalt not section, is you're going to try and find those verses that do address the specific question, right? We ought to be doing that. We ought to be searching the scriptures to try and find, well, when does God talk about this or that? Now, when we do that, we certainly want to do it within its context. We don't want to pluck some verse out of context to say what we want it to say or just to say what it doesn't say. We want to keep these things in context. But in doing this, this classic rule book approach, I do think we can get pretty far in doing this. We can learn a lot of things because the Bible does pretty plainly lay out quite a few things. You can go to Ephesians chapter 4 and you can see, hey, it is not good to lie. We ought to lay aside falsehood and rather speak truth to one another. That's pretty plain. We can see that. We ought not steal, verse 28, steal no longer, but rather labor with your hands, right? You can go over to the Sermon on the Mount. Sermon on the Mount lays out a lot, talks about not committing adultery there, but it also adds to it, the one who lusts has already committed adultery in his heart. So there we go. There's another pretty plain teaching. We ought not do this. But what you'll soon realize is that these commands do not address all of life's unique situations. Not everything is that cut and dry. And so limiting ourselves to just this black and white approach is kind of it's really more surface level. And so what we ought to be willing to do is to dig beneath the surface to try and find out whether something is a sin or not. Because more often than not, the Bible speaks in terms of characteristics, right? This is the type of person you ought to be, rather than observable actions. And that can be kind of difficult. Actually, even within the context of Ephesians 4 and 5 and Matthew chapter 5, you see this. In Ephesians 4, it talks about a lot of practical things, but he uses this phrase, do not use unwholesome speech. Do you think if I were to ask everyone in this audience, what is unwholesome speech, we would have the same exact answer? That's more of a characteristic, right? It's not super specific. Later on in Ephesians 5, no immoral, impure, greedy person has an inheritance in the kingdom. So you can see the weight of this. There's no inheritance in the kingdom for people who are like this. But these are characteristics, immoral, impure, greedy. Would we all have the same definition as to what that action looks like? What observable action is impure or immoral? And all the ones that go into it. And even if we did all agree on what that action is that actually what Paul is talking about here? You can see how that gets a little difficult. So finding the exact proof text does not always answer the question, is it a sin too? And so I think we ought to look below the surface a little bit, and that's what I'd call this step two. I call the Galatians 5 approach. At the end of Galatians 5, Paul goes to two different lists, and you can see it beginning in verse 19 of Galatians 5. The first list that he lays out, which are the deeds of the flesh, which include sexual immorality, impurity, debauchery, idolatry, witchcraft, hatred, discord, jealousy, fits of rage, selfish ambition, dissensions, factions, envy, drunkenness, reveling, and the like. These are all things that will not inherit the kingdom of God. Similar language from Ephesians chapter 5. So when we're trying to figure out whether something is a sin or not, well, let's run it through this list. Does it obviously follow any of these things that we can see? Now, again, he does speak in characteristics, but at the same time, some of these are rather obvious, right? Like, I think we can all pretty well spot when someone is acting out of fits of rage or whether someone is in drunkenness, right? I think we can see some of those pretty easily. So as we honestly and humbly ask the question, is it a sin too? Well, we can filter it through this particular list. But then you can look at another list at the end of Galatians chapter 5 and verse 23, the fruits of the Spirit: love, joy, peace, forbearance, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. And so we can ask the question, does it obviously contradict or oppose the fruit of the Spirit? If it does, then it's probably a sin. Well, I probably shouldn't do that something, right? Maybe we don't have to go any further because we can easily see, hey, this is not loving or this is not gentle. I'm not showing self-control in this, and so I ought not do it. Of course, with some of these, it's a little harder to pinpoint what exactly looks like that. What exactly is envy? Is that person being envious in this situation? Am I being envious in this situation? You can see, again, these characteristics. We might not all agree on the observable actions of impatience or selfish ambition or what, in fact, is divisive. All right? So we got to dig a little deeper then. Go to the next point, which step three, I'm calling this 1 Corinthians approach. And there's this phrase that's mentioned four different times in 1 Corinthians. And 1 Corinthians 6 is where we find it first, if you want to turn there. But several different times in the book, Paul repeats this phrase, all things are lawful. Some versions say, I have the right to do anything. And some versions even put that phrase in quotation marks, which I think is pretty good. A lot of scholars agree that he's quoting a common phrase of the day, something that would have been repeated by many Corinthians, maybe even Corinthians that are in the church there. All things are lawful, used to justify some sort of action. And he says in 1 Corinthians 6, in verse 12, all things are lawful for me, but not all things are profitable. So it's not a bad thing for us to go through this rule book approach to see what God wants from us or doesn't want from us. However, Paul adds another element to this, which I think is crucial. Paul adds this element of, rather than thinking, is it a sin to, like, maybe that's not even the right question to ask. Paul is suggesting here that just because something is lawful or just because something is not a sin in and of itself, should I still do it though? Just because I can, does that mean I should? He proposes this question of, is it profitable? Yes, of course, the civil law gives us certain rights. And actually, within the context, if you go a little bit back in 1 Corinthians 6, you see that some Corinthians were suing one another, Christians suing other Christians. Paul calls this act shameful. Did the civil law give them the right to do it? Yeah. But should they have been doing it? No, that's not profitable for you to do. So you can see that there's many things that might not be a sin in and of itself, but should I do it? Is it profitable? And profitable not in the sense of like financial gain or social gain or something like that, but truly profitable spiritually. You can go down to verse 20 and you can kind of see really what he's trying to emphasize here. For you have been bought with a price, therefore glorify God in your body. The goal is that we would ultimately glorify God in the things that we do. So is it profitable for me in terms of glorifying God better? But he asks another question in the same verse. He says, again, all things are lawful for me, but I will not be mastered by anything. So he adds another question there. Maybe is it a sin too isn't the best question. Maybe I ought to be asking, can this master me? Can this become my master? Is this going to control my life one way or the other? I think that's an important question to ask. And I believe this verse really serves as a transition into another topic in Corinthians that they certainly needed to address, which is sexual immorality. And you could even argue that both of these questions, is it profitable and can I be mastered by it, is said within the context of sexual immorality. But this kind of sexual behavior was rampant in Corinth. It was certainly a part of their culture, and no doubt it had trickled into the church. You can go back to chapter 5 and see how that was true. And then you get people in chapter 7, the beginning of chapter 7, who are going in like the complete opposite direction and saying sexual activity in any scenario, at any time, is not good. And Paul says, well, no, that's not true either. Sexual activity is good in its proper context. So are these actions from the Corinthians, are they lawful? Do they have the right to do them? Well, yes. But Paul wants them to consider a little deeper than that. Are these going to control our thoughts? Is this activity going to consume my mind? Has sexual activity ever dominated the thoughts of people before? Man, there is sad story after sad story within the Bible of predominantly women and sometimes men being taken advantage of because people have been mastered by that fleshly desire. We can see pretty obviously how that's true. And we don't have to look into our own culture to see how it has permeated and destroyed our culture in many, many ways. But I would also argue that even though the context of this question clearly is in the discussion of sexual immorality, I think you could see how this could be applied to other things as well. Can I be mastered by it? Any worldly thing that might dominate my thinking and consume my mind, should I be participating in that thing? Yeah, maybe not. That ought to give us pause, even if that thing is not a sin in and of itself, right? We ought to be thinking a little more deeper than that. But then he comes back to this phrase again in 1 Corinthians 10. Go ahead and turn there. 1 Corinthians 10, in verse 23, he says, all things are lawful. This is the second half of that verse. All things are lawful, but not all things edify. In this context, some Christians in Corinth saw eating meat that had previously been sacrificed to idols as really nothing but eating anything else. While other Christians saw eating meat once sacrificed to an idol as becoming sharers with demons. So you have Christians at the same church who are on polar opposite ends of this spectrum. And while Paul agrees, seems to agree, that eating that meat isn't wrong in and of itself, like before, what's important is not whether he has the right to do something, not whether it is lawful for him to do it, but what is important is, does it edify? Is this edifying to other people? And like that profitable question before, not just edifying in the sense of it like make someone happy, but edifying spiritually, building them up spiritually. Look at the end of this chapter. Look at Paul's focus. Paul lays it out right at the end, verse 32. He says, give no offense either to Jews or to Greeks or to the church of God, just as I also please all men and all things, not seeking my own profit, but the profit of the many, so that they may be saved. Paul is filtering every thought through, how will this profit that person to their salvation? How will this help them go to heaven? Paul's emphasis is not whether something is a sin or not, not whether it's even a sin in it or not a sin in and of itself, but he's considering how this impacts somebody else. And I think this approach, is it profitable? Can I be mastered by it? Is it edifying? I think this approach really gets us closer to how we ought to be thinking as Christians in general. How does this topic in question actually help me? Will it lend itself to self-control? Is it spiritually beneficial to others? And you know what? Like sometimes the answer to those questions may be pretty neutral, and that's fine. That might be the case, and we ought to consider it though, nonetheless. But I do think that this gives us an opportunity to consider some of life's unique situations that the Bible may not speak of directly. But the last one, and I really do think it's a foundational thought, is the Romans 13 approach. Go ahead and turn there, Romans chapter 13. I think Paul really gets to the heart of things here for Christians in chapter 13. Without getting into too much detail of the context of Romans at this time, Paul is in the heart of a more practical section of this letter in Romans chapter 13. He had just gotten done talking about obedience to authority, which really I think fits in a larger context of how we ought to be treating one another. But he says in verse 7, render to all what is due them, tax to whom tax is due, custom to whom custom. And then in the very next verse, he brings the discussion back to the real point, I believe, that he's trying to make is, owe nothing to anyone except to love one another. That's what Paul is trying to encourage us to do. And it's within that discussion that Paul gives some pretty practical advice for those who are trying to fulfill the law through love, as it says in verse 10. Read with me beginning in verse 12. He says, the night is almost gone and the day is near. Therefore, let us lay aside the deeds of darkness and put on the armor of light. Let us behave properly as in the day, not carousing and drunkenness, not in sexual promiscuity and sensuality, not in strife and jealousy. So in verse 13, he kind of lays out these three categories. We talked about parallelism in class this morning. I think you see that. Two words that are really joining together to convey one particular idea. And then these three different categories, the first being carousing and drunkenness. This fleshly desire just to have fun. Just to always be the one who's searching for happiness in every given situation. This laid-back person who just lives to party and have fun and not really take anything seriously and is living for the weekend at every single turn. I think that's kind of what is being pointed out here. The next category, sexual promiscuity and sensuality, rather self-explanatory. This fleshly desire for sex and lust and things like that. And then the last one, strife and jealousy. This fleshly desire, well, to have what other people have and causing problems when you don't. Living in anger and envy and just generally being a difficult person to be around. I think all three of these categories lays out a type of behavior that does not show love to one another, as mentioned in verse 10. But then look at the practical advice that Paul gives in verse 14. In verse 14, and I have the NIV's rendering of it on the board here. Verse 14, rather, here's what you should do. Clothe yourselves with the Lord Jesus Christ and do not think about how to gratify the desires of the flesh. So as we consider the question, is it a sin to? It's as if that question, really no matter what fills in that blank there, fits on a spectrum of sorts. And like step three, maybe it's not the question that we should be asking. Perhaps the better question is this thing, whether it's a sin in and of itself, is this thing pointing me in the direction of the desires of the flesh? Or is it pointing me in the direction of being clothed with Christ or putting on Jesus? Which one, which direction is it moving me? And you can see how that type of thought is foundational, because what it's getting to is more to the heart of the matter. Don't just tell me whether something is a sin or not. I want to be clothed with Jesus. I want to be more like Him and deny myself of these other things. So, let's consider a few questions. Is it a sin to type questions? I know I said that's probably not the best question to ask, but let's just play the game for a minute. We'll start in the shallow end of the pool here, and I'll just give like a lob to you. Is it a sin to watch college football? That's a dumb question, right? Of course it's not. But, well, let's just pause. Let's at least allow everything to be put onto the table, and let's look at this. All right, step one, is there a verse that discusses this question directly? Well, no. Maybe you could come some from outside, but no, there's really nothing. All right, step two, does it lend itself to the deeds of the flesh, or does it oppose the fruit of the Spirit? Well, deeds of the flesh, does it lend itself to sexual immorality and witchcraft? Well, probably not. But what about fits of rage? What about factions or discord? There's certainly been a time in my life where that has described me as far as this topic is concerned. Well, let's ask the question, is it profitable for us? Can this become an obsession that dominates my thinking? I'll tell a story real quick. I was in high school, and one of my teachers put us off into groups. This was before I was a fan of group work. And we're being put into these groups, and we're supposed to be discussing a particular topic. And to show you how much I paid attention, I have no idea what that topic was, but we were supposed to be talking about it. And I felt bad for this one girl who was placed in our group. It was one girl among like four different guys, and all we talked about was college football the entire time. And at one point, she just kind of reached this boiling point of, when are you going to be done? Like, when is it all over? Well, you know, once the season's over, then we got to talk about what the season happened. Oh, and then there's preparation for the draft and who's going to be picked up. Oh, and then there's National Signing Day, and that's always fun. And then then the season begins again. And like, it's never ending. If you want it to be an obsession, it's a pretty easy obsession to have. So we can ask ourselves, can it master me? Can this become an obsession? I think that puts it in a different category, doesn't it? And again, this isn't going to, like, not everyone in this audience has the same response, right? For some of you, this is a pretty neutral thing, and I probably for most of us, it's a pretty neutral thing, I hope. But if it's not, we ought to at least be willing to put it on the table, right? So does watching college football move me closer to the desires of the flesh or being clothed with Christ? Again, it can be neutral, and maybe that's where we settle, and that's fine. But we need to at least be willing to consider these questions. All right, that's the shallow end. Let's go a little bit more into the deeper end. We talked about this kind of indirectly a good bit last week, if you're here for the afternoon lesson. That's the question, is it a sin to drink alcohol? We talked through the Rechabites, and we looked at Jeremiah chapter 35, and how Jeremiah commands the Rechabites to drink, while the Rechabites say, no, we're not going to do that. Let's ask the question, is it a sin to drink alcohol? In my experience, many people I have spoken to on this subject, people on both ends of it, those who support it and those who don't really make it past step one. Because one side waves some verses about drunkenness and partying, and they adopt a zero tolerance policy. But then other people show a bunch of verses about godly people drinking alcohol, and then each die on their hill, and we don't really get anywhere. Now, on the surface, let's just grant that both sides have some verses that support them. Now, sure, you could say that they're, you could get into like ancient techniques of fermentation or levels of alcohol content then versus now, but let's just call it a push. Let's go to step two, because I think there are stronger arguments to be made later. Let's ask about the deeds of the flesh and fruit of the spirit. Does drinking alcohol promote deeds of the flesh like fits of rage or sexual immorality or selfish ambition? Well, it's not really hard to see how that might be the case. Does it promote the fruit of the Spirit, like peace and self-control? Well, not really. It certainly doesn't increase your ability to control yourself. Actually, it's quite the opposite, no matter how little or much you've had. Let's look at the step three. Is drinking alcohol spiritually profitable for me? Is it benefiting me spiritually? Can I be mastered by it? There's certainly examples of those who have been. Now, we have examples of those who are not as well, but there's certainly examples of those who have been. Does it edify others? Or maybe the better question is, do I edify others when I'm under the influence of it? I think that's important. And the last one, does drinking alcohol move me more in the direction of following the desires of the flesh? Or does it move me more in the direction of being clothed with Christ? Full disclosure, I do not think Christians should drink alcohol. If I could be just perfectly blunt in this, I do not think so. But even if you think it is not a sin in and of itself, I would argue that I don't get there because I have the ultimate thou shalt not verse that trumps yours. I get there because I think the wisdom of the scriptures promotes the conclusion that drinking alcohol will not help me in my efforts of denying myself of fleshly desires. And it's not going to help me to put on Christ. I hope that makes sense. And I hope you see how this kind of addresses the question on a deeper level, thinking about how Christ should shape us rather than just what are the things I should and shouldn't do. All right, if we're not in the deep end yet, let's go a little deeper. Similar question here, and I tried to tactfully phrase this. Is it a sin to do recently legalized drugs? There's a particular drug that seems to be legalized in a new state every single year. And well, here in Alabama, it's illegal. So step one approach, pretty easy, right? We can't do it because it is illegal. Well, what if Alabama does what every other state seems to be doing and they legalize this drug? Does that mean that we now have the right? It is now lawful. God wants us to participate in this particular thing, to do this particular drug. Well, I think looking at the rest of the steps would promote a different take. Is it profitable for me, spiritually speaking, to do this? Can I be mastered by this? Can this dictate my life, like financially, but also just in what I want to do, how I want to use my time and things like that? Does it edify others? Or like the previous question, better yet, do I edify others when I'm under the influence of this particular drug? Am I being moved closer to fleshly desires, or am I being moved closer to being clothed with Christ? Perhaps it's difficult to answer some of these questions, but I think we ought to be willing to think about these as humbly and honestly as we can. And then if we weren't already in the deep end, to get to this next question, we're all the way in it now. Is it a sin to wear this or that? Questions on modesty. And I know in some cases this may not seem like too deep a question. I've talked with several people who are not Christians anymore, granted, I think for more reasons than just this, but they say that this was the tipping point when somebody mishandled the topic of modesty. So this is, I think there's pretty big stakes here. When there is an article of clothing that is in question, how do I approach this answer? Well, like I said before, I think there are people on both sides of this that pretty much settle in that step one approach. I've heard people quote verses that apparently have drawn the modesty line as far as the proper length of a skirt or shorts. Like this is the verse that proves that the line is here. I'll be honest, I've never read a verse that has convinced me of a definitive measurement as far as the line of shorts that shorts must cross. Actually, more often that I have noticed is the issue of modesty in the Bible is centered around wearing too much or flaunting wealth as opposed to not wearing enough. Now, thing is, I completely understand why our topics of modesty are centered around not wearing enough, because our culture has gone completely in that direction and we need to address that. And I understand that, and that wasn't necessarily something that needed to be addressed as much in their culture, and so that's not going to be brought up. However, all that being said, I think we can better handle the question of modesty by going through these steps and asking the question, am I promoting the deeds of the flesh in wearing this or that? Am I promoting sexual immorality, impurity, or selfish ambition by what I'm wearing? Or am I promoting the fruit of the Spirit like peace and self-control? I actually think that's what Paul's focusing on in 1 Timothy 2 when he brings up a woman's modesty. He talks about how he calls them to wear things that, when they're coupled with good works, that can't be denied, but when they're coupled with good works, that these things that you wear would profess godliness. Like, that's really what the aim is. Step three, and I think the most pertinent question within those, is what I'm wearing edifying to others, spiritually speaking? Now, again, there could be some neutral points there. But men and women alike must consider this, because I think our culture promotes that what we are wearing is just simply individual expression. I mean, it's one of the greatest ways that we can express ourselves and our thoughts and what we love and things like that. But my question is, well, who are you expressing this to? Clearly, you're expressing it to other people. So pretty clearly, it is going to have an influence or an impact on other people. And as Christians, that ought to be what dominates our thinking. What kind of impression is this going to leave on others? Again, some things might be pretty neutral, but we ought to at least be considering, how does this influence others? Am I getting in the way of the gospel in what I'm wearing? And I think this goes so much more than just how much skin you're showing off. I think that we can get in the way of the gospel in a lot of things that we wear that are distracting and things like that. And we ought to be thinking of what promotes godliness and the spiritual well-being of others rather than just how we feel individually. And then lastly, is what I'm wearing promoting fleshly desires, or does it promote that I am actually clothed with Christ? And to me, this is, at least it's been this way for me, this is far more influential than just finding the best verse that says this is what you should or shouldn't wear. And that's really the point of all of these questions, is getting to the heart of the matter. Because I believe, we all believe, that following God leads to life. It provides gain for this life, but most importantly, for the life to come. And so our natural inclination is to say, like, hey, that sounds great. That sounds wonderful. Give me the instruction manual for all that good stuff to happen. Give me the rule book so I can make this happen. And that's a surface level kind of first step approach. And you know what? We ought to be going through that first step. I feel like I've been knocking that this whole time, because we do get brief moments in Scripture where things are laid out pretty clearly. We get Ten Commandments. We get the Sermon on the Mount. We get parts of 1 Corinthians. But I firmly believe we do not want an exhaustive list of do's and don'ts, at least not entirely. And I say that because even when we do get moments of clarity, even when we do get moments like, hey, do not lust, we so often start to rationalize in our mind of how we can, or that, what I'm actually doing, that's not lust. Or we get moments of clarity like, hey, if you have a problem with someone, go to that person directly and speak to them. And yet we still rationalize in our minds of how we can passive-aggressively maybe post something on Facebook or talk about someone behind their back. So even when we get these cut-and-dry moments, we still don't follow them. Why? It's because our heart is not right. It's because we're not clothed with Jesus. And if those things are not true, then we're always going to find a way around whatever thou shalt not is written for us. So the better question is, am I pursuing wisdom? What's better is when we humbly consider what is spiritually good for us, when we honestly consider if something is actually reflecting Christ or if it's just leading me closer to fleshly desires. And I get how uncomfortable this can be, especially this below the surface stuff, because we're really relying a lot on our own human judgment, right? Yeah, and that is uncomfortable. There is a certain level of discomfort that comes with that. It requires a whole lot of humility and honesty and reflection. And the fact is that some of us are not going to land in the same spot as somebody else. And you may not even land in the same spot you landed in 5 years ago. And that's a difficult, uncomfortable place to be in. However, I really do think that we will land a whole lot closer than we think if our aim is being clothed with Jesus, if our aim is putting on Christ in everything that we do, because that's really what it comes down to. He says in verse 12 that we ought to be putting on the armor of light. So ask the question for yourself, in what I'm doing, am I putting on Jesus? And this is found throughout the Gospels and throughout the New Testament. Am I doing what Paul says in Galatians 2 and verse 20? That it is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. Is that what I'm reflecting? Or as Paul says in Colossians chapter 3, are my decisions reflecting a life that is hidden in Christ? Or I love the way Paul puts it in Ephesians chapter 4. Are we growing into the fullness of Christ? And I really think that verse hits the nail on the head, because this is a maturation process, right? Like, our young people are going to develop these things a lot. It's going to be a lot more difficult for them to kind of process some of these things. Older people can speak out of much more maturity than young people. And so there is this maturation process. We're not always going to answer the question, is it a sin too, the same way. We might go back and forth. Maybe sometimes we go back and forth because really we're just trying to justify our own actions. But other times we go back and forth because we are searching the Scriptures. We are trying to figure out what is right and what is true. But the important thing is that our eyes are set on clothing ourselves with Jesus and growing into the fullness of Christ. When we ask these questions, is it a sin too? Understand that God has always tried to change us from within. And that's what we're aiming for. And yes, we do need to think a little deeper than just that surface level approach. And we're not always going to have a clear answer, at least as clear of one as we would want. And yes, it's uncomfortable that some of us may land in different spots in some places. But if we are having this open discussion, talking with one another about these things, studying our word and trying to become more like Christ, and all the while praying for wisdom and for guidance, well, we're at least starting in the right place. And that's what I hope we can gain from this lesson this morning. If you're not a Christian, there's a lot of things in life that are confusing and that you wish for clarity on. And I truly believe that the scripture is going to provide a lot of clarity, but it's going to do it through a lot of struggle, a lot of reading, a lot of rereading, a lot of discussion, but Christ can change you. When we are clothed with Christ, we are not only just changed in that our outward observable actions are different, but man, our heart can be different. Christ can change us from within. Is that something that you are in need of? If you are searching for Christ, searching for truth, there are people here who want to share that truth with you. If you're ready to commit your life to Christ, come up now while we stand and while we sing.